The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 297 for Wednesday, the 2nd of November, 2011. My name is Jim Race. I am here up in the foothills of Northern California, Jules Cheesek down in the Bay Area. How are you doing this week, Jules?
Doing all right. It's good to talk to you again, Jim.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to say, straight up, right off the bat, that you and Martin did a masterful job last week with a difficult show to put together. And so a tip of hat and kudos to you both.
Thanks, Jim. You know, the thing that I realized today was that this episode is actually much harder to do than last week's, because last week there was a kind of need to speak, you know?
Right.
Whereas this week it's like Everybody's kind of like in the show must go on kind of thing, but I mean, the show must go on, but it's just hard to get motivated.
You know, like last week was interesting for me because of my internet woes at home, I knew that I wasn't going to have the opportunity to watch the race live from Malaysia. And so I ended up out helping a friend with some troubles he was having. And I did not know anything until Sunday morning when I got up post-race and checked my email. And as you well know, email did not bode anything well. And yeah. I kind of went into my own little personal funk and, you know, was just listening, reading, trying to understand. I could not bring myself to watch the race until indeed after the funeral took place, and I watched a bit of that and then listened to your guys' show and then chose to watch the BBC transmission of the race because I'd had enough information to say that they didn't show a lot of repeats and stuff.
Right.
And so, you know, I knew I had to watch it. I just didn't want to watch it over and over again. And I went into it knowing what I was going to see and understanding. And I got what I needed out of it. Yeah, certainly, you know, there's nothing I can say, especially at this late point. But yeah, it was brutal on me. And I just want to say, yeah, I thought that you guys did a great job putting the show together. And I really appreciate all of the listener comments and feedback that we got. You know, the feedback that we're going to talk about tonight is, you know, a little bit more generic, but the feedback that you guys got on the show was well-deserved, Jules, both you and Martin.
Well, and not just that, but also good feedback from people, you know, who had some amazing stuff to say. I mean, the motorcycle community always, any community, when they have a loss in their midst, you know, kind of rises to the occasion, whatever. But I was just overwhelmed with the things that people had to say in general about, you know, what happened in their lives as a result. I mean, you know, we don't know this person who got killed. Something that somebody that doesn't understand, and not necessarily the risks that motorcycle racers take, but why we watch racing, you know, saying, yeah, well, you know, there's like, you know, people dying in Africa from famine, you know, every day. Yeah. How come we don't mourn them the same way that we mourn some guy we don't know who was racing on a racetrack? Well, you know, he was, no matter how removed he is from us, a part of a family, you know, and if you have a family member that suffers a tragic accident, you mourn, you know,
sure.
Yeah, you know what? In a philosophical way, I understand that kind of comment, but nevertheless, this was part of the family. The family lost someone, and you know, you and I have been in the doing the show for many, many, many years, and as a result have gotten a lot closer to it. So we started to see that the family just stays together at a much deeper level than I think a lot of people realize. I mean, I'm sure this is true with any sport, but this particular sport, you know, it's that little town that we always talk about is like moves from place to place, but it's really the same people and there's not that many of them. The bonds are very tight and, it's just really fucking difficult.
I agree. And I think part of the hard part of it, Jules, is, you know, we did this just a year ago.
I know, exactly. It's too soon. it's always going to be too soon, but.
Yeah. I remember, you know, the anguish that you and I went through even talking about doing a show. I remember sitting with you on Sunday afternoon, kind of overlooking the front straight at Indy. And you and I had a very serious conversation about, you know, what we were going to do. You know, it was the first time that it really hit that close to home. We've interviewed Marco in the past. And, you know, we've been close and we've had opportunities to talk to these guys. And it's never, never, never going to be easy. And I, as a racer, understand the risks, and you scared the shit out of myself before, but I, you know, what do we do? Anyway, this one, Jules, is for you, Martin, and Marco.
Nice. Thank you.
A moment of noise.
right. We'll get on that a little later. So there was a lot of feedback that Martin and I talked about possibly airing in this week's show, but you know, there's been a great outpouring on the Facebook page and in the emails, various forums. It could be a very long show.
Yes, it could.
We just basically want to thank everybody who wrote in and shared your little personal stories, and some of them very personal, and your feelings, and you know, in the spirit of the GP paddock, you know, going back to racing, let's just get back into the show.
I think so too. You want me to dive into some listener feedback here?
Yeah.
Cool. Alan Fleming, who is becoming the Martin Darlington of new writers in, wrote us in a couple of good pieces, and we're going to zip through these, and you've got a bunch of commentary and I've got some too, and then we'll get on some other stuff, because I do want to talk about how the complexion of the GP paddock may change too.
Yeah.
Alan said, regarding the Mark Vidius team 2012 Ducati option, which, I always interspersed.
Just to put a little bit of context here. Some of these emails are from a couple of weeks ago. So, they see me like, what? Didn't we talk about that? Long time ago.
Yeah, but this is still unresolved. Yeah. And we're still wondering if it even might happen. In fact, frankly, you had an interesting conversation I saw through Twitter with Ian Wheeler regarding the, you know, BMW suitor and all that. So, you know, who knows what's really going to happen, right? But Alan went on to say, personally, if I had the money I'd opt for a satellite 2012 duck over a CRT. While 1,000cc is a risk, the current assumption is that CRT bikes will be challenging the satellite bikes. And Jules, you and I both kind of wonder about that, and that all depends on how much fuel they get and what happens, what Carmelo wants to put into it, right?
Yep.
He goes on, while the 800cc duck has been the runt of the litter, I might disagree with that too, given circumstance. But anyway, compared to the Honda and Yamaha factory bikes, it has bested their satellite bikes in 2011. Either Rossi or Hayden have beaten all the satellite bikes on all but three occasions, and two of those were rain races. If the 2011 D16 is closer to a 2012 bike now than what originally started as a 2011 800, and keep up with us here, folks, then the satellite version may stack up favorably compared to the 2012 satellite Hondas and Yamahas. Jules, we almost need to like a connect the dots here, don't we? If nothing else, it may be less of an unknown than a CRT bike, but admittedly a much larger financial gamble. And he carries on, and God bless him, Alan. And one more thing, the Redding. While I understand the Redding size issue, I still think he has been too inconsistent this year to bet the bank on him to head to the big leagues. We all know Marquez isn't going to ride anything without Repsol and or Honda written on the side. So if I were investing Ducati-sized money or Jules Marlboro-sized money in this project, I'd be digging out a German phone book. And you this is where you dive in, and I like what you say.
Oh, I just said that the comments are very interesting. But I think that you need to consider that at least at the start of the 2012 season, the satellite teams will be very close to what the factory guys get because there'll be nothing really... There'll be no, like, you know, last year's parts. I mean, there will be some, obviously, 800 parts being used in the 2012 bikes, but nothing major, right? And remember that in 2007, Gresini beat the factory Hondas at Jerez, Le Mans, Laguna, Misano, Motegi, where the Tectuat team also beat Fiat Yamaha, though that was a wet race. And I'm not sure if that counts, but... And then Sepang, while Pramac beat Factory Ducks at Mugello, and then Barros and Pramac supposedly paid the price by getting shit for suspension from that point on, that was a very kind of controversial maneuver that Barros did on Stoner and took the podium away from Stoner. So you know the whole like. The satellite bikes are as bad as a CRT thing, you know. I think that the satellite bikes in the first year of a new formula are that's the closest they're ever going to be, all right. And as to Redding, I think its inconsistency was actually has to do with the tire wear in the Moto2 class. So if the Bridgestones continue to last as the well they do, that might actually really play well into his hand. As far as the German phone book, I do agree Bradle should move it to MotoGP, but I think there's some, they just don't have enough money, I don't think. Bradle and,
well, I mean, and, yeah, he put forth 2.5 million euros, and that wasn't enough. Like,
yeah, isn't that crazy?
The fuck?
I know,
yeah,
it's crazy,
yeah. Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So a couple of points there that I can make an add-on to this. One of the things is today, I forget where I chased the link off, maybe off of a story that on Moto Matters. And I forgot that this website is still around. And it's very cool that it actually still exists and is still around and is still fully populated. And I believe it was the BlataWCM.com website. It's still there.
Oh, wow.
With everything. And the whole WCM effort with Peter Clifford and Bob McLean and everything that happened there, that was kind of the original CRT, if you think about it.
We should fill in people, because I think this is almost ancient history. This is like 8-9 years ago. So give it a little bit of background, because this is a very interesting story with the whole...
Sure. It was the beginning of the four-stroke era. You remember, Jules, that there was an announcement that Blatta was going to come into MotoGP and build a
six-cylinder thing, right?
A V6. And you know, I think I made comments back then, because all Blatta had built up to that point were mini bikes, you know, little mini road racers, which were very cool, and they were the top of the class at the time for those bikes.
Mm-hmm.
But these are little, you know, 50s, 60, 40 cc two-strokes. And... yeah, okay, right. They're going to come in and, you know, a Czech team and put forth the effort into building a V6 and, you know, bitching, but can they actually pull it off? They weren't able to. And so ultimately what they did is they used, I believe it was a Harris chassis, correct me if I'm wrong, with an R1 engine that had been massively modified. Internals were completely modified. And it changed over time, but right off the bat, And I couldn't say it. I forget my history here a little bit because, like you say, it was a long time ago, 2004, I believe. Dorna said, this is, you're using a production engine. And they had to make changes, massive changes. In the end, even all the changes that they made were not enough for the series organizers to allow them to continue running, and they were bumped out of the class and weren't allowed to run. And I believe it's blattowcm.com. Regardless, we'll put a link. Make sure we put a link in the show notes because it's pretty cool. And there's a bunch of history there. And all they have a huge photo gallery, which is way cool. Fun stuff. So at the same time, what was the other thing that I was looking at today? Because it was, you mentioned the Barros Pramac win at Mugello.
Yeah.
And I happened to stumble across, I've been going through hard drives since I moved, and I happened to pick up a hard drive, and it found a hard drive, Jules, it'd be appreciative of this, it had all the photos from back in then, which I still have, yay, all the team photos, and I found all the team photos from that, which were very cool, and talk about an excited group of people, including our own pal that we have to have on the show one of these days again, Mr. Liam Schubert.
Yeah.
And you're right. Yeah, they shit on him after that. And I believe that's a technical term that's actually quite applicable.
I mean, we did see Tony Elias on the podium again at Brno. I think 2008, was it?
Yeah. I think that was more fluky than what I thought was Barros's relatively, ballsy win over Stoner.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a win-win, but definitely over the other Ducati, the factory Ducati, because the Brno thing was that was a different situation.
Yeah, he challenged him on the front straight, didn't get past, challenged him on the front straight, and then went for a classic outside over the line pass on the front straight. I still remember that race quite well.
Great.
You want me to continue with Alan's stuff?
Yes. Go ahead. This one is even longer. So hang in there.
And so you switched to email because.
Well, this was about a week later that this email came.
But it's still good and topical stuff. So Alan says, maybe we should get him on the show one of these days, Jules.
Be the next super fan turn to host,
Or we can have a super fan round table over the holidays like last year.
Oh, yeah.
That could be a disaster. All right. Alan says, continuing, honestly, after Sepang, I haven't had the motivation to think about racing until today. However, after hearing your discussion about how long riders are staying competitive, I wanted to provide a different view. First, I agree that enhanced safety since the 70s allowed riders to stay healthy longer, this weekend's tragic death notwithstanding. I also understand that changing up the rules has prevented a single manufacturer and or rider from dominating for long periods of time, though Rossi's string between 2001 and 2008 show how important adaptability is and the difficult skill might prevent riders from having long successful streaks. However, and he carries on, we're not going to stop for a while. I think the most important factor is not riders riding longer, as back in the 50s and 60s, privateers were doing well against a small factory field well into their 40s. In one of my many GP history books, I have a list showing the oldest riders to win GP races, and nearly all of them were back in the heyday of British singles against Italian multis. I think the oldest in 250s may have been Aprilia test rider Lucci, won at Mugello in 1998.
I think it was 44 or 45 years old.
Something like that. It gives me hope. Well, not anymore. He says, and I agree with this 100%, says, I think the deciding factor is racers starting earlier. And Alan, I'm going to add to this a bit. I think they're starting earlier and having more opportunities because there's just more stuff out there and more small bikes for them.
For racing, for actual racing, exactly.
Yeah, instead of just putting around. I think the deciding factor is racers starting earlier and starting with better skills and more experience. Proliferation of training camps, youth racing series, and formal national racing programs has brought more competitive racers into GP at an earlier age. I was looking at some stats recently and was amazed at how many age-related records have been broken in the past decade. Granted, the change to MotoGP and the improvement in tires may have allowed younger riders to do well faster in the premier class, but records have fallen like crazy in 125 and 250. Some examples. Jules, should we go through all these?
No, not all of them, but just read off, because right. Basically what Alan did is he meticulously went through and found
detailed everything,
almost every right. record under the sun that was, you know, in yeah. terms of age.
All right, I'm gonna touch on these, and if I skip something that you want me to touch on, you dive in, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, so Valentino Rossi, what can we say about him? Youngest rider to win 250 GP championship in 99. Youngest rider to win championships in all three classes, 2001, that being 125, 250, and 500 GP. Mm-hmm. Marco Melandri, youngest rider to win a GP, 125 in 1998. I wish he'd mentioned the ages here. That would have been good. Norikabe, youngest rider, started 100 races in the premier class, 500 GP in 2001. And, it occurs to me, Jules, when I read that earlier today, that that's kind of fallen out of my memory. And he was super prolific in 500 GP.
Incredible. Yeah.
Casey Stoner, youngest rider to score points in 250 GP. And I think he was, what, 9?
Yeah.
That was 250 GP in 2002. And I'm pretty sure he was, I can't remember.
Well, he's 26 now, so.
Yep. Jorge Lorenzo, youngest rider to take part in a GP race. That was 125 GP in 2002. Chaz Davis, youngest rider to score points in 250 GP in 2003. Danny Pedrosa, smallest rider to win. Oh, wait. Youngest rider to win a 250 GP race in 2004. These records just going on. Paul Espargaro, youngest rider to score points in a GP, 125 GP in 2006. They keep coming down, his point being. John Hopkins, youngest rider, started 100 races in premier class, that being MotoGP, as opposed to Norikabe in 2008. And we kind of keep forgetting that John Hopkins is actually still young, and we'll talk about him in a bit. Scott Redding, youngest rider to qualify in the front row of a GP, 125 GP in 2008. Youngest rider to win a GP, I think it was a Brit GP in 2008. Mark Marquez, youngest rider to win everything in his first year when he thought he wasn't going to win anything at GP in 2009, and podiuming in 2008. Valencia, 2001. These things are kind of interesting.
I really like these ones that he pulled together.
Yeah. These ones are kind of interesting, I think. Valencia, 2001. The 125cc podium was the first all-teenage podium in any class of GP racing, which made whatever the European version of Team Beat is quite happy. Mm-hmm. Catalunya 2005, 250cc podium was the same, all teenage podium. LaSalle, 2005, the youngest 250 GP podium in history. That's a cumulative, if you added all their ages up. 2008, youngest premier class podium in history for GP. It goes on and on. 2008 in Donington, once again. He says, of the 10, of the 10 youngest riders to win a GP, all in 125 GP, over half have occurred in the past 10 years. And so, Jules, I go, okay. And I think Alan's point is well taken, is training, early starts, things more methodical, if you will. But yeah, crazy. He finishes up with this. Racers may be racing longer, but they're also starting at the GP level earlier and much more competitive. He thinks this is the key factor in why riders seem to be having a longer window of success in GP. And then he closes out. Ooh, if I have to be by the character, clearly I've overdrawn my 2 cents. Time for me to put away this stack of books, close down all my Google search windows, and to say a silent prayer to Mr. Raines. That being one Martin Raines.
MotoGP statistician.
Indeed. Clearly a brilliant resource.
Yeah, great. So great job, Alan. And you made your case, and I'm convinced.
Yeah. Well, no kidding. I think we already knew it, but it's good to have it laid out like that.
Yeah, and you know what's I mean, yeah, sure, every sport has in every sport there are records being broken in a certain direction, you know, in running they're going faster. In motorcycle racing, because back in the day, like when he was talking about the 50s and 60s, you really didn't have to have talent, like this the kind of talent that the guys have to have now to ride, you know, a bike with this precision. You didn't have to have talent as much as kind of perseverance and balls, you know, just pure balls. And I know I got in trouble for saying that before, but, you know, those machines were not going to outride the rider as much as they do these days if you don't train. I mean, look at how fit every one of those GP riders is these days. So you got to start them off earlier. But I think the biggest one is that the opportunities are there. There's a support system for it. A lot of these families of the younger racers kind of grew up in the racing community. The kids kind of grew up in the paddock. I remember which one of our friends in the AFM has pictures of his like 3-year-old riding, like steering a big leader bike around the paddock with his dad on the back, you know. But it's amazing, you know. It's amazing how quickly the kids are indoctrinated, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you pull it back to, you know, the kids that we know from here in the States and local to us, Jules, you know, you think about the Peter Lenzes and the Elena Myers and the Bobby Fongs and kids like that, you know, that started racing minis around here. They had, you know, at Stockton Motorplex, they started in the same, or, you know, the Weir Minis or SC Mini GP or whatever. They all started with organized mini stuff and quickly graduated to bigger tracks and learned them quickly and learned them well with super supportive parents, mind you. Parents that weren't and aren't pushy, that let the kids, and I say kids now because some of these, they're not kids anymore,
uh-huh.
You know, like push themselves to their potential.
Yeah, I mean, you look at even, you know, Cimicilli and Dovizioso, that whole story absolutely began when they were 4 or 5 years old, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
The story of those two guys.
Yeah. Crazy stuff.
So, yeah, great.
All right.
Great email, Alan.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And then we were talking about the, a couple of weeks ago, we were asked about the last time that a factory team had a DNS, you know, which is a did not start, not a DNF, in a GP race. And Edward Kress tweeted that actually factory Suzuki didn't have a rider in Qatar this year because they, which is totally true. And you win, Adam. Bautista broke his leg during free practice. And he also missed Jerez, which is when John Hopkins scored a couple of points. But we were talking about a multi rider team, obviously. So we just, cool. Poorly...
I have a question for you on the what if front.
Yes.
What if Bautista hadn't broken his leg that badly, and considering the progress that
he had made,
that team made as the year went on. Can you imagine a what if for Suzuki? I mean, do you think they could have?
It's massive considering that we still haven't heard anything from them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very true.
And now we're kind of in a weird limbo with the team. And
yeah.
We'll talk about that shortly too.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, lastly, we had a great series of posts from Darren Wade, who is a listener who was at Sepang, who went to Sepang to watch the racing. And he emailed us, and he posted on Facebook, and you know, unfortunately, because of the events, some of this, you know, I think he had to see the very dark side of it all, and including some of the poorly handled communication to the fans and the fans' reaction to the cancellation of the race. And so, Darren, thank you very much for writing in to us. And for posting all your pictures and stuff on the video that you had on the Facebook page, and
yep.
Yeah, hopefully your next round will be a sunnier one. All right, let's go down to the main topics.
Main topics. All the craziness in MotoGP. And kind of craziness all around, if you will. We do know that Fausto Grassini and the full team is going to actually be racing at Valencia with a full Moto2 team. Hiroshi Aoyama in MotoGP with Simoncelli's bike displayed in the garage as a measure of respect. And so props to them, because there had been word earlier, Jules, as you know, it actually kind of bounced around if they were going to show what they would do. And so I'm very pleased. And it sounds like it almost sounds in a way, and it sounds trivial and bullshit, like they're going to have a celebration of Marco's life, which I think is what they're going to try and do. And I think that's fantastic, as much as they can.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. Everybody is kind of clamoring for, the respect that you pay Marco is by continuing to race, making noise, you know, instead of the minute of silence. His father said, why don't we have a minute of noise? You know, just have all the bikes in the paddock, 125s, Moto2, and the MotoGP bikes just all run their engines, revving their engines. I mean, all that stuff is great. I also think that it's really a cool thing to do for Hiroshi Aoyama, because he's leaving MotoGP. He's going to Superbikes next year. And this is the track that has special memories for him. Maybe not necessarily. Yes, he did win the championship here in 2009, but it was a nerve-wracking one, if you remember. But I think it's important that he gets a good send-off as well. He's been a big part of the paddock for so long. So I think it's awesome. I think it's great. And
I'm definitely looking forward to see what they come out with. Absolutely. I could use, it's a Valencia that at first I was like, do I want to watch? But now I certainly do. I've had my ups and downs about Valencia, as I'm sure you have over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it'll be pretty cool. I do have to say, Jules, that this next topic that you have is about the most loaded one that you've ever put. You have six simple words that could probably be in an hour and a half conversation.
I think we should just touch on it and then save it for off season.
All right. Well, off season, when we'll actually have a fair amount more information, although there is a fair amount coming out, and frankly, it might be, off season is next week, is it not?
Oh yeah, we can get started soon. Just not today.
Okay. Do you know what? Here's what I think we should do, Jules. Let's ask the question and leave it at that, and let listeners write in and tell us what they think.
All right, sounds good.
Okay, so I will ask the question. And we'll stop right there if we can. All right. So the question being, is Espeleta, that being Carmelo Espeleta, declaring war on the MSMA, that being the Motorcycle Manufacturers Association, the factories that supply the factory bikes to the MotoGP paddock? And you guys out there that have paid attention to, or have even if not, you have heard of MSMA and certainly Carmelo Espeleta, write into motopod@motopodcast.com and tell us what your thoughts are. And as you know, we read a lot of stuff on the air, and perhaps we'll play it for you next week. How's that?
That's good. That's good.
All right.
But the MSMA, get one last kind of rule change before, I guess, the first battle, begins. But which is funny, because there's a reversal of the rule that they asked for in the first place, which is that the testing limits sort of being abolished. I put down it's being abolished. You said sort of, because I guess you talk about the tire limits. But
not only the tire limits, but if they were being abolished, then we wouldn't have a winter break.
But the winter, but is the winter break enforced?
It's still, yes.
This year?
Yeah.
You sure about that?
I believe so. I have heard nothing about it not being taken away, and I've read nothing about it not disappearing.
So basically we're going back to what testing kind of looked like, you know, at the beginning of the decade, last decade.
Yeah. What they've essentially done is the term abolished is kind of a sensational one, a sensationalistic one, if I consider it. I think it's more, I would say, very much relaxed. But again, yes, the tires are still an issue. But what they've done is they've allowed the factory riders to have a lot more leeway, because clearly the factory riders can get a lot more performance and information out of the bikes than, granted, some very fast test riders can do. But they can't push the bike to 100%.
Plus, every rider is different. Their needs are different, you know.
Exactly.
You know, Rossi obviously is a brake guy. He goes to who's testing? Is it Batteini?
Yeah,
I think Batteini is Francesco Batteini is testing for
and Vito.
Well, yeah, Vito Guerreschi, but I don't know how much his role as a team boss kind of interferes with his testing time and stuff, you know, and vice versa actually. And but yeah, so the thing is, you know, they sit down and talk about, well, here's what I thought, you know. It was strange when the testing limits were put in the first place. Like before that, it seemed like the winter break and summer break were really just so that the riders could have some time off.
Jules, let me point out a massive piece of this puzzle is as we switch to 1,000cc bikes and we have CRT bikes coming in, which are going to be these twisted little Frankensteinian prototype things that everybody's going to need a shitload of testing. Yes. And for at least
no one's complaining. I mean, that's why, you know, the first thought, I'm sure, through many people's heads was, oh, Rossi gets his way again, right? Because, you know, look, he's always pushing. Carmelo Ezpeleta will do whatever it takes to make sure that Rossi is successful, blah, 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 blah. The thing is, all the manufacturers were like, yeah, we wanted to go back to, you know, testing when we want to with the riders.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, that's the knee-jerk reaction and perhaps a valid one, but then we would have to revert to the prior question that we asked of our listeners, was is Ezpeleta declaring war on the MSMA? who knows at this point? But I think it, at least for the time being, is going to benefit all the teams, and particularly the ones that are coming in with a relatively raw knowledge of what they have as a package. And
now here's the thing that I don't remember. I don't remember reading about this, but did the CRT teams have a testing limit? Because maybe in a way this is actually is worse for the, because I think they had more testing allowance than the factories, at least more. Well, maybe they didn't have a limit at all. I don't know.
Well, we really haven't seen. Okay, put it this way: CRT teams have been testing like crazy, and we haven't heard about it because we don't have to, because there aren't any limits right now, right?
Right.
Coming into the winter season, you know, if somebody wants to take the time to actually lay all this stuff out on like a Gantt chart, which might be fun if you think about it in a way, it would be kind of cool because really, you know, including engines, including tire, because there is an engine allowance for, and Jules, that's an additional thing. There's an engine allowance for the testing period. The same thing with tires. I have no idea if there's fuel, whatever. That probably won't matter. You know, there's even been talk of potentially increasing the fuel allowance for the CRT teams next year if they need additional fuel. And that may even actually happen before the beginning of the season.
Right.
And then we fall back to the prior question. who knows? That's why, you know, you had a you had a 3-word thing that actually ended up being even longer. they're not abolished at this point.
I like the term relaxed. I like the term relaxed.
Okay.
That was the right way to say it. But the main thing is that you're not gonna have, you know, some test rider flown in for an emergency track time because the previous weekend they didn't get enough data out of the free practice qualifying and race, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're going to be able to go and, you know, if they need to do a lot of work, they can spend, you know, their tire allowance and stuff. And right. So then the other news item is that Moto 2 is going to remain a single engine class from 2013. So, and they had a meeting in Sepang, and they decided that Honda is going to be the engine for 2012, 2013, and 2014. I mean, they already had the contract to 2012, but it's been extended to 13 and 14. So,
now, Jules, I do want to point out that we have not seen FIM documentation on this yet.
That's
true. This came from a tweet.
From Matt Burt at MCN. He's proven, you know, we used to say, you know, MCN was kind of like, you know, take a shot. If it sticks, people will go, wow, you guys really had inside info. And if it doesn't, then nobody will remember. But they've been actually extremely reliable source of information over the last 2 years or so. So I believe
just not when they're talking about a V4 Honda for the road.
Oh boy! All right. let's see. So we went to Suzuki, right? Because Suzuki was supposed to have announced their plans in Australia. Then they were supposed to announce their plans in Malaysia. And now they're going to be waiting until Valencia. Meanwhile, there's still riders without rides. Specifically, you mentioned Alvaro Bautista, and you know, the longer that this doesn't get announced, the worse it sounds. You know,
right. But that being said, Jules, there's also rides without riders right now. So you know, it's a bit of a musical chairs thing, right?
Yeah, but those rides, aside from Simoncelli's bike, are are, you know, last straws for a lot of these riders, right? I think even though Suzuki may not be the best bike on the grid, and we know that it's not, it's still a factory bike, and there's a lot of benefit on being on a factory bike, you know. So Alvaro Bautista has turned down offers for satellite rides many times. To stick with Suzuki.
We also kind of wonder, as you said, Simoncelli's bike, that being at Gresini, if that bike may not move to LCR with another rider.
Right. Right.
So that's what I kind of mean by musical chairs. It's like, where is everybody going to land? You know, DePugne, you know, we have Taka Vainone coming up. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things, but obviously Valencia, given by the end of this weekend, or at least by the end of Monday, I would guess, I think we're going to have everybody signed in one way or another. I don't think I've ever seen it go this long. No, I think we'll have everything done.
I mean, I hope so, for the sake of these riders that are sitting around waiting. And I will, you know, I mean, like we you and I talked about this 2 or 3 weeks ago about the fact that Suzuki may very well race this year's bike. I mean, there's nothing stopping them from racing 800 next year, so they can just race. They can still bide their time, and you know, and then you know, either put in a 1,000cc bike or pull out during the season. So, you know, anybody who takes gamble with them at this point, this late in them not still not having announced anything, they're taking a huge risk. Because yeah. I think if they go and they say, okay, well, you know what, we're going to start the season next year with 800s and you know, we're working on, there's been absolutely no noise about this, you know, the Suzuki 1000. So Yeah, I think it would be a huge risk. And I know Alvaro Bautista is a fairly well-sought rider. I mean, he's obviously been able to make that Suzuki do things that not many riders could have been able to do, you know?
No, yeah. it will be interesting to see where all of these guys land. And I think that this weekend, it's going to be, if you think about it, kind of like bowling pins in a way. And there's certainly, you know, this whole week coming into the race and being back on European soil where everybody's based and all the teams are based, especially going back to Spain, that there's tons of stuff going on as we speak, Jules. Well, maybe not. Well, maybe so, because it's almost 8 in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
In Spain. But I would bet that there is a ton of stuff going on, and probably as early as, you know, the time the show comes out, or Friday, or maybe even Wednesday of this week, that we'll have a bunch more answers about where people are going to be working next year.
Right, right. And in the vein of the Is Espeleta declaring war, you know, granted, I had to run this through Google Translate, but there was an interview with him that a lot of it is written about it, but the specific thing that I caught in that was kind of not mind-blowing, because I knew that kind of that it was going on, but I just didn't realize that the level at which it was going on was a subsidy that Dorna was giving to the satellite teams. And I'm sure that even though he didn't say it, that there was a subsidy being given to Suzuki as well.
Well, sure.
You know, I think for example, the Kawasaki turned Hayate team, you know.
Who do you think kept Hayate on the grid?
Yeah, exactly.
And with great angst at the same time. You know, we never did quite hear, if you think about it, because Kawasaki, if word is true, violated the contract that they had been bound to keep, you know, factory teams on the grid if there was any recourse. Or because you remember when they first said they were going to pull out, there was threats of lawsuits and whatnot.
Right, right. Now he talks about this. I'm going to link this article for sure. I think you lose obviously a lot in the translation. So if you speak Spanish, you know, you'll probably get a much, much better feel for it. But there was a lot of little hidden nuggets in there. So yeah, we'll link to that as.com link.
All right, let's roll through here, sir.
Very quickly, just to bring everybody back up to speed, you know, obviously we've got 125s and Moto2 championships decided. Nicholas Tirol leads the 125 championship by 20 points. And because he has more wins than Johann Zarco, he just has to get 5 more points than Zarco, mm-hmm. and he's the winner.
Yep.
So, you know, Zarco has to win, that means, for him to have a chance at the championship. So it'll be interesting, because this is a very Spanish heavy series, 125s, and they have been known to work together before.
You think?
Gabo Talmashi had an interesting run in with those guys, although he was having none of it. But back in 2007.
Jules, it was interesting. Before this, I'm like, you know, I need to watch some racing. And I was wandering through the stuff that I had here, and I said, let me watch 125s from Aragon again.
Oh, yeah.
That was a good race to watch to warm up for the call. Mm-hmm.
Bob Bell, the wingman.
Anyway, yes, indeed. So you talk about the Spanish influence and Spanish mafia, if you will. Moto2 as well. We've got a bit of stuff going on there, but we'll have to see how that goes out, don't we?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen, because we don't know whether Marquez is even going to race. We still don't know. I mean, he's getting checked out still. There's been absolutely no word anywhere about it. Now, granted, by the time you listen to the show, maybe everything will be clear. But this is Tuesday night in California. And so, you know, if he doesn't start, you know, Battle is the champion. if he races, you know, all Bradle has to do is finish 13th. But he does have to finish, and he has had one, you know, crash this year, and he has had a couple of races where he struggled, and he is up against, you know, again, the Spanish. But
and the race is in Spain.
And he's in Spain. Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's going to be, for him, it's going to be the ultimate test of nerves if Marquez does race, and if Marquez is doing really well during the race, that's going to be the test of Bradle's mettle. I think he's totally up for it. I think this guy has, you know, nerves of steel. But it's good. I'm really hoping that Marquez races. I really, really hope he gets a race.
Absolutely. I would love to have, we once again have the opportunity that seems fairly rare these days to have Valencia offer something to seriously tune into, frankly, in all three classes this year.
Yeah.
And so I'm pumped for it. You know,
we have to go back to 2009 and 250 championship with Simoncelli and Ayama. All Ayama had to do, quote, all he had to do was finish 11th.
Yep.
Right?
And the big runoff.
And as long as Simoncelli didn't win, he was fine. But if Simoncelli won and he finished 12th, then he would have lost the championship, Ayama. And what did he do? Yeah. He went off, you know, in the fastest corner, which thankfully he didn't drop it, but he still had way to come back. He came back, he was in 11th, you know, and then Simoncelli crashed later in the race and gave the championship no matter what to Ayama. But for those tense moments, I mean, Jesus, can you imagine what that must have felt like?
Yeah, no doubt. Ugh. No doubt. So, I mean, we've got a whole bundle of good to go. I haven't even looked and seen what the weather is like for this coming weekend because there's been so much other, you know, more personal drama going on. But if weather happens to play a factor, I know it's going to be playing a factor with me for this weekend.
Oh, good.
For you and I both, we're about to get pounded by a couple of storms, but it should be pretty cool and something to really look forward to and something to actually drag me out and figure out a way to actually watch these live this weekend.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I think anything's open at 2 a.m.? From 2 a.m. to 5 a.m.? Or 6 a.m.?
I can figure it out, even in this little one-horse town.
Cool. And speaking of times, daylight savings time ended in Spain this last weekend. Our daylight savings time in the U.S. ends the morning of the racing, which means that be careful about how you set your DVRs or whatever if they're not upgraded, because how many times have we changed our DST dates late in the last few years, you know?
Yeah. It's the same. Unless, of course, you live in Arizona, which is a state that little parts of it don't change anyway, or
right. And in Australia, I believe Australia started their daylight savings at the beginning of October. So remember that for you guys, remember that Valencia is going to be off of daylight savings time for the entire weekend, whereas U.S., it's just complicated. The best thing to do, and I tested this because I actually set my browser to different time zones, is the MotoGP website has it nailed. So if you go there and click on local time, those are the actual times for the entire weekend. So FP1, FP2, FP3, QP, racing, warm-up, all those things will be correct. Just go there.
Until they're wrong.
What's that?
Until they're wrong. I remember they were wrong about 2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm always checking. That's why I'm always checking, because I know as a programmer, that is a bitch to get that
Jules,
stuff right.
Jules, I think the best way to do it is just not go to sleep and just like sit.
Well,
there,
that's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do. Just keep it live.
A final couple of things on MotoGP. You actually started talking about how you translated this, and then you lost it, and I distracted you elsewhere. How you had translated the Rossi quote?
Oh, you mean the we call it the effing vibration because it's the last moment before the black hole. That one.
Yeah, that one.
Right. Yes, I didn't actually know. Somebody tweeted that. I think Rossi tweeted that himself. In case you guys don't know, he's on Twitter now, Valet Yellow 46, occasionally posting in English. Right.
And on top of that, he has a translator that is now posting and translating his tweets that I think I saw somebody point to. And on top of that, I think Uccio is on there.
Uccio's been on there for a while, I think, actually. But you know who does the best translating for him is Davide Brivio, because he translates and turns into PR speak at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, and finally for MotoGP this weekend, I do want to mention.
Oh yes.
Josh Hayes, who's been on the show more than a few times, including
just this year,
and GarageBand stuff in the past with Chaz Hayes, a whole bunch of other people. This year's 2011 AMA Superbike champion will be substituting for Colin Edwards, who is injured from a horrific accident at Malaysia on the Tech 3 bike at Valencia. So go, Josh, and best of luck, and enjoy the ride, sir.
So, Jim,
and I think,
Jim, yeah. How do you think Josh will do?
How do I think he'll do? I think he'll get a point. At least a point, if not a few.
I think if he starts, he gets a point. I mean, if he finishes the race, he gets a point, probably.
I think a lot of it depends. Josh has clearly shown adaptability. He's a guy that actually, though, likes to ride with very little traction control. A lot of times when he races, he turns it down to one or off. And so with the amount of electronics that are required to ride a MotoGP bike, specifically, you know, granted the Yamaha, and certainly it's in its step down, if you will, a slight step down with the Tech 3 squad, although you know they're going to be bringing full guns for everybody since this is the last race of the year with the 800s, and they can do pretty much whatever they want because those will be going to museums or slag heaps or wherever. Perhaps they'll get full kit, but the time required to adapt to these things is tough. You know, the time required to adapt to the tires, you know, he's not raced on Bridgestones. Time required to adapt to the circuit, Valencia. He's a versatile rider. You remember the time that he spent in World Supersport, and he adapted to that very quickly. And
But I think what catches out a lot of these riders, though, that come off of superbikes is the brakes. You know?
Oh, absolutely, no doubt.
He's going to find new muscles.
or find that he doesn't have new muscles.
But, right.
You know, for a guy that's, I think Josh is 37. I'm sorry, Josh, if I got that wrong or aged you. 36. Dude's in brilliant shape. I mean, he's one of these cyclists that are just completely many. I think he'll do fine, and he'll definitely score in the points, I think, if he stays on the bike. If you want me to throw a guess, I will give him 11th.
Really?
Yeah.
This with four riders falling off, or?
I will give him 11th.
Wow. Okay, dude. That's good. I like it. I like it. We don't actually know even, again, this is Tuesday night. You're probably listening to it much later in the week, and you probably know already, but we don't. We don't even know if Jorge Lorenzo is going to be there. Looks like he's going to be there, but we don't know for sure. So
you know what? Jules, I think I heard, what did I hear about a test rider? I thought I heard something today about a test rider. I'd have to check back. Well, everybody out there will already know, and you guys can just go, oh yeah, there's a test rider. All right, let's see if we can wrap this thing up, Jules. We got some World Superbike news. I think we had this last week, but we can catch you up on it. Eugene Laverty has been inked to join Max Biaggi at the factory Aprilia squad.
Yeah, the last time we talked about it, he was joining Aprilia, but we didn't know whether they're going to expand the official factory team or whether it was going to be the Italia team, but whether he was going to, you know, maybe get like a Haga type ride, but now he's on the full bike with Biaggi.
Yeah, because when he tested actually on Haga's Pata bike with generic white fairings. I have to talk to him. You know, we haven't talked to him in, I guess, a year or so.
It's getting too big for us.
Maybe. I guess I have to talk to him just to, say, I can deal with Max, but I think Max is a different Max, or maybe not, after the slap fights with Marco, or Marco Mondri, but I think that'll be cool. And he was quick right off the bat at Portimao on the Aprilia, and I think he was second quickest.
He may be a really good match for that bike, because he's also, some of our listeners might forget that he was in the 250s for quite a while, and so he has a very similar he's ridden bikes that need this kind of skill set that Biaggi possesses. For example, Biaggi's obviously been a big part of the Aprilia project, so I think he'll do quite well on this bike, actually, and all this super sports experience as well.
Yeah, I think so too. There's a name that we haven't heard as signed in World Superbike, unless I'm completely cracked.
What's that?
Is where Chaz Davis is going to end up next year.
Well, there's that talk about the Ducati.
There's talk, but yeah. There's no 100% guarantee that exactly what happened. We talked about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago, that exactly what happened with the World Superbike sport bikes doesn't happen to the Yamaha R1s, and they come back in different guys next year.
Right.
At the same time, there's also been some murmuring that if Lorenzo doesn't run this coming weekend, that Chaz may show up and possibly run there, because he has run on the Bridgestones before.
Yeah, he's been in GPs, obviously, on a MotoGP bike. So yeah, that's that I have not heard anything about, but that'd be interesting to see, of course. Obviously Jorge Lorenzo is going to try to be at Valencia the Spanish round, but with the championship already decided, and who knows what how his finger's doing.
Yeah, I really don't look forward to any pictures of the post surgery.
I know. Then I'm seeing the pre.
Yeah, exactly. Finally, or at least close to finally, we did get note today on Tuesday that Leon Camier has signed for Suzuki. That kind of does leave open the second spot, this being Crescent Suzuki in World Superbike.
It was funny too, because Leon Camier tweeted that he's going to have a big announcement later. That was yesterday. And then Neil Spaulding tweeted, "Oh, you mean the same one that Paul Denning's going to announce?"
Yeah, it's pretty funny how Twitter really has become people were kind of being cagey at first, and you're like, "Oh, okay, if I know something, I'm not really going to say anything." No, it's a free for all now.
No, I mean, dude, in Aragon, the journalists, they put their recorders down. The writer starts talking. They take out their Blackberries, their iPhones, and they're recording the interview, which is what they're going to do the like long interview from. But as soon as the writer says something, it goes out into a tweet.
Yeah, well,
amazing.
I wish I had the bandwidth to pay attention to it at this point, and that's kind of my goal, to get one of those things taken care of. So we might have to see, because we never know. Once again, if John Hopkins, if he does not manage to negotiate a GP rider wherever that silly season culminates in Valencia this weekend, if he won't be there in GP land, or if he doesn't end up back at Crescent Suzuki, but he is kind of favored to be at that. And remember, the Crescent is also going to be running still a squad back in BSB, and they certainly had a good year there.
Yeah. And we don't know who's going to be. We don't know any of the riders there.
No, we don't. We don't. Finally, we hope, and we think this is going to happen, but...
weather permitting.
You never... yes.
Weather permitting.
James Whittam. Should I continue?
Oh, James Wooden will be, you know, talking to Martin in person. As we mentioned last show, we've already got a couple of good, really good questions from people. Keep sending them in. The deadline is Friday.
Deadline really is Thursday.
Yeah, it's really as soon as you hear the show. If you still haven't, you know, emailing anything in, any questions for James Wooden, please email them now.
Cool.
We'll get them to Martin so Martin can ask him. At least if they're good, make them good.
And I will state this, and you have to leave it in, Jules, that I have been chatting back and forth with Mark Miller, and we are going to talk before he races in Macau.
Okay, cool.
Currently he's on the Isle of Man. He's been jaunting over Europe. So Mark, I know you're out there, and I know you listen to the show as soon as it comes out. So let's figure out a time, dude, to talk about it. It's like text good. Going back and forth.
This is, you so know, you're basically using this. It's like, you know, it's like the parents talking through their kids. They're arguing. They're talking through their kids. You're using the show now to contact Mark.
Totally. Totally.
Well, Mark, you've been served.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Yeah, actually, Vero, if you hear Mark listening to this and he hasn't called me yet, tell him to call me. All right. Thank you, dear.
There you go. All right.
All right.
Well, we're going to sign off. I'm looking forward to seeing some championships, the final two championships resolved in Valencia. And then we're going to go into the dark period of winter, where we're going to discuss the war and other interesting topics. Of course, we'll still have Macau.
This is where we really start making stuff up ourselves.
Yeah. All right, Jim. Good talking to you, man.
Absolutely. And yourself as well. To try and stay dry. You're not going to be able to do much commuting on bicycles or motorcycles at the end of this week, I hear.
Yeah.
All right, man. Ciao.
All right. Take care, everybody. Thanks for listening. Ciao.
Just for a moment, hold on. Save that for the end of the show. yeah, welcome back to the regular show, right?
Exactly. Thank you.